Accession number 28897, reel 14.
This is the eighth reel of a taped interview with George Oliver in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 7th of the 4th, 2006, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. George, obviously, talk to us about your crash landing,
yes.
As you say. you mentioned that this young chap at the time had seen your plane being attacked by Messerschmitt.
Yes.
Another instance, I understand, that you were to learn later on was what you were carrying at the time.
Yes.
What was it that you were carrying aboard the plane?
Well, we were told that it was a bomb bay full of mortar bombs. Now, I don't know how dangerous they were, unless they'd been... I can't think of the word, but at any rate...
Primed,
yes. We didn't know at the time what we were carrying. We never did. They didn't ever tell us that as a rule. But we did know that there were a couple of packages of petrol in the back, and that's what the army dispatchers were there for. They were quite big, meters. Oh, I don't know how big they were, really, but there was a fair bit of petrol in these things, and they were going to throw them out on parachutes. But of course they were still in the aircraft when it landed, so yes, I suppose we were pretty lucky that we didn't blow up, but I didn't have much choice anyhow. It was either crash landed or try and crash landed, and there was too low to bail anybody out.
Well, my impression too from a lot of the interviews that I've done is that there is a very fine line between being lucky and being dead.
Yes. Yes.
During war.
Yes, well, that's true. It's, I think most people that survived it would say they had a fair share of luck. But on the other hand, too, you had a better chance if you were competent. When an emergency cropped up, you know, and then you had a lot of luck as to whether anybody attacked you or not, too. It was a bit strange sometimes to, when I saw that aircraft just in front of me lose his wing. I mean, it could have been me, and that was luck, I suppose. Yeah. But as I've mentioned before, we were well trained by the authorities in those days, and forced landings. We'd gone almost to the point of landing several times with one engine or two engines or something like that, and the instructors used to just switch the engine off and say, pick out a field and go down there. And so we'd been psyched up to it to some extent, and I think that makes a difference. And then after I'd seen the wing fall off this other aeroplane and just in front of me so quickly, I think that influenced my decision to try and crash land it. Anyway, that's what we did.
What do you, and I'm safe in saying that we haven't discussed this, but what experiences did you have of the unexplained? When people talk gremlins, they talk of things like Foo Fighters and all sorts of unexplained incidences that were happening in the air around them.
No, well, you can get very disoriented if there's searchlights shining up on an angle through clouds and things like that. And I had one, I might have mentioned this before, I had one experience where I could, the aircraft seemed to me that I was losing, one wing was dropping, and it almost made me slide out of my seat. And I looked at my instruments, and the instruments said that your wings are dead level. So I accepted that. And what I found out was that it was this light in the sky there was the moon. It was actually the moon I was looking at, and there were sort of lines running across the sky on an angle, and you wanted to sort of level it with the horizon. You know, that was your instincts to do it. So you can get that light that I saw then. We used to say that if an aircraft stayed in the same spot on your windscreen, you were on a collision course, another aircraft, you see. And because if it didn't move across your windscreen, you were converging. And when I saw the moon, I thought I was converging onto something, you see. And then I realised it was the moon. So there's all sorts of funny things. But I didn't ever think about gremlins, or I didn't carry a rabbit's foot or anything like that.
Well, I think it was Ron who was saying that he actually discouraged his men from thinking about that sort of thing and relying on things like rabbit's feet.
Yes. Now, my crew didn't do anything like that, in, as far as I know, anyhow. And we weren't supposed to carry anything in case we weren't supposed to carry anything personal, so that we could be identified with.
What was sort of the personal attachment that you got to plane?
Oh, the personal attachment. Oh, yes, it was almost love. It's for your old aircraft.
So it must have been a difficult situation when you realised you were going to have to ditch it.
Oh, well, I didn't think about that at the time. Survival was the top of the order that in those few minutes. Yes. Afterwards, I've got pictures of it still, with the old elephant on the front there, and I've got a piece of it hanging up in my family room.
What was the elephant? Where did the name elephant come from?
Oh, well, it was easy, you see. That was the phonetic alphabet in those days. I don't know whether it's the same today, but E was the easy. And we used our aircraft was called E easy, you see. It was LJ851 officially. That was its number. So Cyril, the ground staff sergeant or whatever he was, I can't think of his rank, he said, you know, would you like me to paint an elephant on your aircraft for easy? And I said, yeah, that'll be nice. And I said, what's it going to represent, Cyril? And he said, what was it? Solidity, I think, or something like that. Solidity. I don't think that was the exact word, but he meant that. Something strong and solid. And, of course, a lot of chaps that I think I've mentioned before that you thought of the aircraft as your own, because generally speaking, on our squadron, at any rate, we had kept our own aircraft. If we went on leave, someone else flew it. But while we were there, we kept our own aircraft, as long as it was serviceable, that is. And so we became very attached to them. You might think it's funny being... You might think it's funny me using the word love when I talk about an aircraft and an inanimate object like an aircraft. But we were certainly very fond of them, and we weren't that pleased when other people flew them either, really. That's just one of those things with young blokes, you know. I think some people feel the same about their motor car, not that I ever have, but...
It was certainly an important inanimate object for you, given the work that it was helping you to do.
Yes. Your life relied on it, performing, you know. I only ever had one, it wasn't an engine failure, I only had engine trouble once in all the flying I did, and that was with a runaway prop. I don't know whether you know what a runaway prop is, but all of a sudden it started to windmill, Well, the engine cut out, that's what happened, and it was windmilling, you see, and they windmilled at a very fast speed, and I'd heard stories that sometimes if the engine seat is up under those circumstances, the prop flew off, you see, and went through the cockpit or something like that, or through the wing. So I was very anxious to feather this thing, you see, and I had a bit of trouble feathering it. It wouldn't feather and it wouldn't feather. And I eventually got it feathered by practically stalling the aircraft and slowing down and eventually practically stalling the aircraft. And then it stopped, gradually stopped. Apart from that, I had no engine trouble in the air with the and all that. Mm. And we used to watch the. Of course, we had a flight engineer watching all the temperatures and so forth. And we'd both done that engine handling course at Bristol Aircraft Factory. So. Well, I think we knew what we were doing at any rate. We had a fair idea of what we were doing. Mm. Mm. But that's right. The old tub, as we used to call it, that was our bread and butter, really.
In relation to love, I wanted to talk about you being married to Jean and the process of that. I mean, people have talked about contemplating getting married prior to the war and putting it off till they came back, and people falling in love and sort of shying away from getting too close to one another because of the realities of the situation.
Yes.
What was the situation with you?
Well, we were in love, there's no doubt about that, and we'd met at a dance, and I'd walked Jean home, and her mother opened the door and have a look at me, I suppose, and it was pretty late at night, of course, after the dance, and so her mother said, oh, Jean introduced me to her mother, and her mother said, well, you'd better invite him around for lunch, so she did that, and at the first opportunity, I went around there for lunch one day when flying was cancelled because of the fog. I said to the flight commander of the CO or somebody there in charge, can I have a bit of time off to go into Leicester? I've got friends in there that have invited me to lunch, you see. I didn't mention that it was Jean. But we're in love, and I used to go and see her at each opportunity when we got leave and so forth. And then she was a teacher, and she used to come down a couple of times and stayed in a hotel not far from the base where when we were at Tarrant Rushton for a while. She came down, and so then we got engaged in May, and I don't think we considered much about the war because I'd grown up in the Great Depression when things were fairly tough out here, a lot of unemployed people and so forth, and my dad was always employed, but a lot of people around weren't and so forth, and so I'd seen a bit of hardship in that way, witnessed it at any rate as a lad, and so the war was on, we wanted to be together, and someone said the past is that's gone, and the future's here. The present's here, and the future's a mystery. Well, the future certainly is a mystery. I mean, we didn't, we couldn't even see the end of the war at that stage, really. D-Day hadn't even taken place then, and so we couldn't. I don't think we ever thought about whether it was going to be successful or not. And it was in the days when, as far as my bringing up was concerned, that if you wanted to live together, well, you got married. So that's what we did. These days, probably they wouldn't bother that.
Well, I understand that you were discouraged by a number of mates not to.
Oh, well, some of them were much wiser than me, you see, and they told me stories about how their dad had said that whatever you do, don't get married. Their dad had been to France in the First World War, and he said all these wartime marriages fail and so forth. Some did, but there's a lot that haven't. Jim's in the British War Brides. They've got a function out here with girls that married Australian airmen, and they're going strong. And they've assisted greatly with the population of this country and been populating this country. All good citizens too. So, but no doubt there were failures, but I don't know that there'd be any more failures than what there would in normal life, really. Anyway, that's what we did. I decided that it was stupid to worry about the future. And of course, there was the possibility that I'd be killed, which I suppose when I crash landed, I was 2 or 3 seconds from that, and she would have been a widow, but she'd have married again anyhow. She was young and attractive, so, or if she'd wanted to. And we just lived in the present. Mm. That's putting it blunt.
That's something else that I get from the stories of people during war, that you live for the present, you live for the now.
Yeah, that's right.
Nothing stopped.
No, well, that's the way we were. It's impossible to put your attitude into the minds of people that live in a different environment. And so that's the way we did it, I suppose. Most of the servicemen did that. But we were fortunate in as much as that being airmen, we lived on a base, and in the UK, of course, there were towns nearby and there were girls nearby. So whereas the chaps like my dad, who was captured and taken up onto the Burma Railway by the Japanese, they might have seen some girls in the distance, but they couldn't do anything about that sort of thing. So I think the truth of the matter is, if you put young men and young women in close proximity, that's what's going to happen. I don't think there's much doubt about that.
That's pretty natural to me.
Yes. Okay, so we did get married. And
did that make your job more difficult?
No. Well, I think it gave me a bit of an anchor in a way. And I think the being welcomed by her family gave me a bit of an anchor. It's a pretty lonely business if you're away from home and away from your friends, and it can be lonely, although we had a lot of good mates as well, but it's not quite the same. And I think it did my morale good, actually. Yes.
You talk about what sort of difference it made for you following the end of the war. My impression is that those chaps that had someone to come home to did a lot better than those that didn't. But for the time being, I mean, obviously we've spoken about D-Day, and we've spoken about Arnhem, and we've spoken about your plane landing in the field.
Mm.
What was to happen next? You'd mentioned you'd been brought through Brussels and that people were celebrating because at that time they had been liberated. What were you to do next?
Well, we reported back to the squadron. I told you that the story that the Anson that took us over, scrounged a lift on an Anson from Brussels, was carrying blood plasma and stuff like that over to the battles. And he asked me when we got over England, we didn't care where we were going as long as it was over England. And he asked me where we were stationed, and I said Keeble. He said, "Where's that, near Bath?" I said, "Yes." I said, "We're near Bath." And so he said, "Oh, I'm not too far from there." He said, I'll drop you in." I think I've told you this story before anyhow. he dropped us in, and no one had expected us.
We were sitting around for a while, waiting.
Yes, that's right. And we waited on the tarmac there, and there was nobody around, and then eventually a truck came and picked us up, took us back to the flight office, and everyone was amazed and told us they thought we were dead or prisoners of war or something. And and I asked the old adjutant, he was old, he's a young man to me now, but he was old then, he was World War World chap. I asked him if I could ring my wife up, tell her I was safe, and I'll never forget that, because he said, of course you can, God bless you, lad. And he was a decent old bloke. And I went on another operation shortly after that over Holland, and then I came back, and we were doing some flying with the airborne boys again. And I think it was the 1st Division this time. Well, it was, because they were the ones that the 1st Airborne Division, they were the ones we took to Arnhem, so we were flying with them a bit still, those that hadn't gone. And I was doing a few air tests. And at any rate, one day they said, well, a few of you are going to be screened. That meant that you'd finished a tour of duty, because we'd been on the squadron a year. We'd joined it when it was first transferred from Bomber Command. Well, we were in it when it was in Bomber Command, but we didn't do much, Ron and I. But and then it was transferred to Bomber Command in November, and it was a year later that they screened us, it was a bit over a year. I think it was Christmas before we actually, Christmas 45, when we actually left the squadron, and we became screen instructors. And that's more or less, I did 6 months doing that, flying around on cross countries with trainee crews. And that was supposed to be less risky than operations. But there was certainly a bit of a strain there for all that.
Well, I was going to ask, it sounds
a
bit risky to me.
Well, I don't know of any real tragedies except the one that my flight engineer had, and he was also screened like that, but he got transferred to somewhere where they were flying Halifaxes, an intruder. The Germans seemed to send over quite a few intruders towards the end of the war, they got shot up by an intruder, and the pilot tried to do what I did, but he killed himself in the process. And Dennis managed to bail out. I think the pilot bailed them out. I don't know what height they were at. They must have had a reasonable height. He bailed them out, and then he tried to crash land the aircraft. But something went wrong. But Dennis survived, although he injured his back quite badly, because it was fairly low. He says it was about 800 feet by the time he got out, but I don't know how he'd estimate that, but it was pretty low anyhow. Another intruder, I might have told you this story before, after Arnhem, towards the end of the war, I think it was, one of our squadron boys, I wasn't on the squadron at the time, but I knew the chap concerned, an intruder shot them up and set them on fire just as they were approaching to land after an op, and the rear gunner was killed instantly, and I think there were about three killed, and one was very badly burnt, and the pilot managed to crash land that before it blew up, and it blew up just after landing, so half the crew were killed. So that's how things can happen quickly, thinking they were home, ready to land. get some bacon and eggs or something.
Mm. You're mentioning also a time when you witnessed a plane coming in over the cliffs.
Yes, have I told you that story?
Tell us again, just in case.
Oh, okay. Yes, well, Jean and I, by this time, of course, we were long, we'd been married quite a while. That was, I can't remember when it was, but it was sometime in 1945 that I was still doing this screen job at the heavy conversion unit, and I had some leave. And so Jean and I, one of her sisters had friends who had a holiday apartments in Cromer, which is on the coast. Can't think of the county now, but it's on the coast there, on the east side of the UK somewhere. And we were just sitting on the beach in deck chairs, you know, like the English do. They like to sit on their pebbly beaches in deck chairs, and we were doing that. As far as I recall, we were in deck chairs. We were sitting somewhere anyhow, and I saw this Stirling coming along, and I knew that he was in trouble because he was flying parallel to the coast a bit, and he was gradually descending, and I could tell by the sound of his engines that he'd lost his engines, I think, or had lost most of them, or they were malfunctioning at any rate. And he came along, and there was a cliff just a little further down the coast from where we were sitting, and then there was high ground above the cliff, of course, but there was a little beach, not a very wide little beach, at the bottom of the cliff before the water, you see. And I don't know whether, I think he originally might have wanted to crash land on the high ground and then thought he wouldn't be able to, he was losing too much height, I think. And I think what he did, he came in from the water and he turned starboard, and it looked as though he might have been trying to crash land on the shallow water, but at any rate his wing hit the cliff, and it just went straight in, and there was no, wasn't a sound came out of it at all. And funnily enough, his name was Pat Carroll, the pilot, but I didn't know that at the time. I didn't even know it was the one of our squadron. I only found that out after the war. And I looked up the date and everything of when this crashed. I found that out somehow, and it was definitely the one we saw at Cromer, because the dates tallied. And I mean, you wouldn't have two of them happening. And Pat Carroll was one of the pilots on the 196 squadron. And just a couple of years ago, two or three years ago, Mr. Carroll from Queensland contacted a few of us and wanted to know whether we knew his father. He was interested in what had happened to him. He knew his father was killed, and he's buried in the UK, not too far from Cromer somewhere, I think. And that was when I found out that that aircraft we saw crash was one of our own squadron. So that was a bit of a surprise. Jean saw that too. Yeah, we were both sitting there together. Yeah, so Mr. Carroll got a bit of information. I wrote him a nice letter and told him that I wasn't actually a bosom pal with his dad, but I knew him quite well, and I told him his dad had served with honour.
It must have been a difficult thing to watch, too, for both of you.
Yes.
You know, this sort of thing going on a nice, calm beachfront.
Yeah, we were there on a holiday and didn't want to, weren't hoping to see something like that. It did shake us a bit, yes, it did. No doubt about that. It just seemed, when you see it happen like that, I've mentioned a couple of times when I saw it happen like that and knew that everyone in the aircraft had been killed, does give you a jar.